Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Joe Zimmel and Valerie Friedman.
This is Where We Live from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. Maybe you've noticed social media is a great indicator that the public generally doesn't know much about history. Today, Where We Live, we tackle why. Coming up, we'll hear from a historian who has studied how abolitionism, slavery, the Civil War, and Reconstruction have been taught in U.S. textbooks for generations. First, there's been debate in various states about changing how history is taught in schools. Now that debate has reached Connecticut, where just this month, students testified before state lawmakers in support of legislation to add African American and Latino studies to social studies curriculum. Ryan Lindsay was there. She's reporter for WNPR, Connecticut Public Radio, and the Guns in America Public Radio Reporting Collaborative. Ryan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us more about the students who are really supporting a couple of these bills before the General Assembly.
Yeah, so at the hearing, you had students from Hartford, New London, Enfield, New Haven, Windsor, a lot of different towns in the public school system, and they really came to voice why they feel like Black studies and Latinx and Puerto Rican studies are needed here in their classrooms. For them, they definitely felt like they don't feel represented. And as we know, representation matters. And so that's something that they were trying to communicate to legislators during that public hearing.
So when they look back at the history, social studies curriculums throughout their public school career, so to speak, when would they have seen themselves represented at all?
Generally, it's just slavery and civil rights. And you may get a dabble of, you know, random selected Black history during Black History Month, but there's really not a comprehensive curriculum that makes them feel represented, that they can see themselves reflected back in spaces outside of being an enslaved person or fighting against racism and things like that. It definitely, from what I heard from them, it definitely feels incredibly limited, and that's not something that they want to. There was a desire to have a better understanding of who their ancestors were, their contributions, Black and Latino contributions to the country, and they definitely let that be known in the hearing.
So you talked to several of the students, also, again, covered this public hearing before a legislative committee. Tell us what some of the students said.
So this is the clip we're going to hear is Sean Brooks. He is a student at New London High School, I believe, the Science and Magnet School. And so he is just speaking about, you know, to be a young Black man in high school when oftentimes Black men are seen as just athletes or, you know, just a strong labor force. Why he felt like the need to be included in his classroom. So here's Sean.
I support the enactment of this bill because as an African-American male, I tend to feel isolated in the classroom due to the fact that the other U.S. history curriculums focus on white exceptionalism and Black inferiority.
So when these students who are involved in this effort, when they think about Black history, it's more a footnote or relegated to the month of February?
Yeah, I mean, if that's all you're being told from elementary school on through the end of high school, that it's just MLK, just Rosa, maybe you get a little sprinkle of Malcolm X or the Black Panthers, depending on your school system and the curriculum, you know, that feels very limited. It doesn't speak to the Black Arts Movement. It doesn't speak to a lot of the Black intellects and authors. Some of the students talked about, you know, you're hardly reading anything, whether it's in your English class or social studies, like, who are the Black authors, right? Who have contributed thought in terms of how we move through the world in this nation and the things like that. And so without that, they definitely feel an absence. And even in some schools like, Bloomfield High School, it's 93% Black. And if even amongst an all-Black student body, if you're not being told about yourself, then there is this understanding of, okay, well, who am I in the world? Where did I come from? Who are the people that have contributed me to me becoming who I am today?
Besides covering the public hearing, you had a chance to hear from students even prior to their travel to the Capitol. Tell us about some of the students and what they told you.
Yeah, that was a really interesting conversation to sit in on. These are students in the Greater Hartford Youth Leadership Academy. So, again, they come from a lot of the different towns, and they meet pretty much once a month, or every Saturday. And so they were having a conversation in preparation to write these testimonies. So we're going to hear from Desra. She's a student at Windsor High School. And so the students have kind of been going back and forth. Well, we got to do this for Black History Month. We got to do that. And so here's her response to that.
We just have announcements that just give a fact, and that's fact, and that's it. We don't have, like, y'all days where y'all, like, read books and you look at movies and everything else. We just like, oh, get that one Black History Month fact, mm-hmm. and we just go about our day.
Again, in studio with us is Ryan Lindsay, who is telling us about some of the students, some students of color in Connecticut, who are supporting a couple of different bills before the General Assembly that would mandate that public schools teach African-American and Latino studies within the social studies curriculums. I'm curious, as you were talking with them or listening to them, Ryan, do they feel supported by their own history teachers? And what did their teachers look like?
There's a little bit of tension there. Oftentimes, well, at least here in Connecticut, there's such a small percentage of black educators, I think just around 3%. And so when it comes to something like Black History, whether it is, you know, a small portion in Black History Month, the students are wondering, do these teachers actually understand my struggles? Do they understand? Can they empathize? Do they respect and appreciate the history of the people that we came from? And so I think for them, you know, one of the students was talking about that being a challenge. Actually, a couple students said that being a challenge for them is like they're looking at their teacher and they're like, you know, I want to receive this history. But even Desra said that she didn't do particularly well in one of her classes because it was a white teacher who was teaching different African-American material.
And that statistic is important from the State Department of Education, that 91% of teachers in Connecticut are white. We've talked with the Connecticut Mirror, who've analyzed that data, too, that 23 school districts in our state don't have a single educator of color. And the ripple effects of that, Ryan.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important because there are also statistics to say that when a black student has a black educator, how that really has such a positive impact on their education. And I know that for these students, that's another thing of expanding their ideas of who and what they can be in the world. So if you're seeing a black teacher, whether it's science or math or English, not just your black gym teacher who you think is really cool, right? That really is helpful for them in thinking about the possibilities of their life and thinking about college going forward. I know that, you know, even in my schooling, there were some black educators, and it meant a lot for me to have a black English teacher or a creative writing teacher. And then, of course, you know, pursued African-American studies in college. But again, like, if I hadn't had those black educators or even my mother being an educator, then I think I probably would have thought differently about, okay, is this something that we as black people do? So, yeah, these students, it really matters for that type of representation. But even something they said, which I thought was pretty interesting, is that it's important. One of the things they said is it's important for black studies for everybody to learn, all races, so that there can be an appreciation, there can be an understanding, and there can be more conversations. And when that becomes normalized, then there will hopefully be less of an instance for a blackface, you know,
incident. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Dory on Twitter writes, teacher training is going to be crucial. It is possible to teach African-American and Latino studies in a way that reinforces stereotypes and ethnocentric perspectives. If we want to combat racism and inequality, we only need to teach these subjects. We have to teach them well.
Yes. There was, within the testimony, the public hearing, there was a social justice organization that in New London, that was also in New Haven, that was pushing for a history of race and racism component to be added into the curriculum. And so I think that part of their thought around that was that we want to understand how racism has shaped how we think about ourselves in the world, who has access to certain benefits and how we're treated certain ways. And so that was something that was communicated. And also just like how racism operates throughout society, right? And so those are things that we might learn by personal experience. Or one of the students, she was a black student, she said that her only understanding of racism was just someone being called the N-word. And as we know, that's not just simply not the case. So there's a lot of concern and a lot of just I'd say passion in really wanting this curriculum, both Black and Latinx curriculum, to be added to be taught year-round.
You know, there may be listeners out there who maybe don't agree with the idea that the state legislature is mandating particular curriculum in local school districts. We should say, and we've talked about this on the show, that the General Assembly passed and then Governor Malloy signed a bill dealing with history education, and that's mandating that the Holocaust and genocide also be taught in public schools.
Yeah, and I think there was a great need for that as well, because, again, any place you have a group of people, whether it's people, you know, Jewish folks, they want to be able to learn about their history too. And as we know, there's been a rise in anti-Semitic acts across the country and even in schools, swastikas being carved into desks and things like that. And so we want to have, it sounds like they want to have this education and this knowledge possible so that we can avoid things like that happening within the classrooms, or avoid maybe even a teacher being burdened with not knowing how to diffuse that type of situation or have a sensitive conversation around that. And so with these statutes in terms of these curriculums, it's something that the state is saying, these are the things that we want to be taught in the classroom. And these are the things that are required, just like math, just like science. And what happens is that the local and regional school boards work together with groups of stakeholders. So maybe they're historians, maybe they're a cultural society, right? Educators and people who are really invested in writing a comprehensive, or what the State Board of Education said, a robust curriculum. And so this is something that took about 8 months for the Holocaust and genocide curriculum. But it was something that they asked for these two separate bills, 7082 and 7083, for about another year, because it was looking to be implemented in the 2019-2020 school year, but they're looking for that to happen over the course of another year, so they can really have as much, you know, in the curriculum as possible.
And Ryan, before you go, again, these bills before the Legislative Education Committee, have they been voted out? Do we know?
They haven't been voted out yet, but that should happen within the next couple weeks. And then, of course, it has to be voted out voted in the House and the Senate floor. So we'll see. But it did seem like there was widespread support from a lot of legislators there. So we'll see.
Ryan Lindsay, again, is reporter for WNPR, Connecticut Public Radio. Also, the Guns in America Public Radio Reporting Collaborative, a really interesting project. We hope to have you back to talk about that, Ryan.
Thank you so much.
This is Where We Live from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. Coming up, how bad are history textbooks? Pretty bad. And the problem can be traced all the way back to the 1800s. We'll explain right after the break. And you can join us, too. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. You can also join us, 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. History is written by the winners. The Atlantic reported that saying appeared in the Boston Herald in 1929 and was attributed to a cynic. Do you think that saying is spot on? You can join us, 860-275-7266, or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Today, we wanted to explore the way Americans have learned history and the efforts to strengthen knowledge today by including the full context that's often overlooked, especially in school textbooks. I want to welcome to the show two guests. First, joining us from a studio in Memphis, Tennessee, Charles McKinney, Director of Africana Studies and Associate Professor of History at Rhodes College in Memphis. Charles, welcome to our show.
Thank you for having me.
Also joining us by phone is Donald Iacovone, associate at the Hutchins Center for African and African American Research. He's currently writing a book called Teaching White Supremacy, The Textbook Battle Over Race in American History. Donald, welcome to Where We Live.
Good morning.
So I wanted to start with Charles. I wanted to ask you to respond to efforts in Connecticut. We just heard from a reporter here about students of color wanting the state to mandate African-American and Latino history to be taught in Connecticut. Is this type of effort or movement taking hold in the country?
I certainly hope so. I was reading up on these efforts initiated by students in Connecticut. And so first off, bravo to the students in Connecticut for taking point on this. I think their arguments were just spot on about all of the things that all of the good and positive and productive things that can happen when we incorporate this type of history. So I've heard of instances scattered around the country. I think California passed some recent similar legislation as well. So hopefully this is a trend that will continue and really start to thrive as we move forward.
But for the majority of public school social studies or history classes, when we think about the history of people of color in this country, often a footnote?
Yes. Often a footnote. We've seen in recent decades, there's been some really voluminous pushback against that inclination to center white folks, right? To center European Americans, to center the actions, the history, the thought, the wars, right? Started by the majority of the European majorities here in the nation, and that diminishes us. That's not good history. Right, quite frankly, right? History is written by the winners, and in most instances, the winners aren't very good historians, right? So we miss so much about the complexity and the nuance and the reality of the American narrative when we simply focus on the white guys, quite frankly, right? When we skip from Christopher Columbus to George Washington, to Abraham Lincoln, to Teddy Roosevelt, to Ronald Reagan, to Donald Trump, we've woven a narrative based in American exceptionalism. We've woven a narrative that suggests that that justice and equality is an inevitability. That's something that's going to continually just sort of grow automatically. We miss complexity. We miss nuance. We miss all of the vibrant contradictions of the American age. We miss African Americans. We miss Latinx folks. We miss all of the non-white folks who are also key players and key constituents in American history, right, in the shaping of the nation. And when we miss them, then we are all diminished.
So I wanted to get into how we got here. So Donald Iacovone, again, is with us by phone. You have looked into the textbooks that have been in public schools around the country. So tell us first, who are the writers of these textbooks, Donald?
Well, of course, it depends on when, what period we're talking about, but because certainly early on, most of the authors of these textbooks were not trained historians. There really weren't any trained historians in the way we think of them today. So in the 19th century, you would have people like Noah Webster, the grand creator of one of our first dictionaries, who crafted a book that not only excluded people of African descent, but excluded most of the South as well. In fact, according to Webster, the only people who mattered were Puritans, and Connecticut Puritans at that. So you've got a long legacy of amateurs and educators who are crafting these, and authors, just popular authors, who are writing these texts, and it isn't really until the mid to late 19th century when we start having trained historians that we get scholars who are beginning to contribute, and then you have sort of this filtering down of scholarship down to the level of like grammar school texts.
So before that, when we think about textbooks writers, mostly Northerners?
Yes, absolutely. There were some Southerners, but they generally come a bit later. Yeah, these are mostly Northerners. Also, depending on what time period, you get people from the Midwest. Chicago becomes a major center, but also Tennessee, where the Peabody School Nashville began, authors there began writing textbooks, and you have an awful lot of educators, particularly later in the beginning of the 20th century, who are from the South, who are writing textbooks, but in order to avoid some of the problems that come with a national perspective, they tend to substitute state textbooks, state history textbooks, for national history textbooks.
So. And when we think about the people who were writing these textbooks, you know, there is a common feeling that, well, if they're in the North, they weren't racist, but the way Northern writers were writing about African-Americans was pretty racist.
We're talking about an era of white supremacy which extends right to this very day. There was a period after the Civil War during and after Reconstruction in which individuals who had an emancipationist view of the Civil War, the meaning of the Civil War, did write and write some pretty good textbooks. I'm thinking of the Civil War reporter, Charles Carlton Coffin, who wrote several. Thomas Wentworth Higginson, who commanded the 1st South Carolina Volunteers, wrote a textbook. So you do get an emancipationist view of the meaning of the Civil War during the 1870s and 80s and 90s, but it begins to weaken, and certainly by 1903, 1904, that tradition is dead as it comes. And we have the rise of the lost cause interpretation of the meaning of the Civil War, which really grabs hold. It had been developing, you know, ever since the end of the Civil War, but really grabbed hold in the beginning of the 20th century and did not let go until the 1960s. So you've got generations-long tradition of, in this case, the losers crafting the history.
In your research, Donald, you came across your own fifth-grade history textbook. How was slavery explained?
Yeah, you know, it was quite a shock. I was at the Harvard School of Education's library, the Gutman Library, and there it sat on the shelf, and I looked at it, and I said, I can't believe what I'm looking at. And it largely ignored slavery. There was one sentence which said that people in the North, over time, began to think it was wrong to sell human beings. That's fine. But the Civil War was fought over states' rights, and the greatest hero to emerge out of the Civil War was not Lincoln, not Grant, but Robert E. Lee. Mm-hmm. And that reflected the thinking of authors across the country, and it, in fact, I was looking at one right now from 1957. Same thing. Robert E. Lee is pictures everywhere. He is the iconic American hero. Terrific irony.
This is Where We Live. Today we're talking about why history is often told from one side but doesn't provide a lot of the context that is necessary to understand how we came to be where we are today. My guest today, Donald Iacovone, associate at the Hutchins Center for African and African American Research, currently writing a book called Teaching White Supremacy, The Textbook Battle Over Race in American History. And with us from a studio from Memphis, Tennessee, is Charles McKinney, Director of Africana Studies and Associate Professor of History at Rhodes College. Charles, I was wondering if you could respond to some of the research that Donald has done on textbooks and, again, how slavery was portrayed and how it's still very much that message throughout certain states and textbooks today. Just recently, Texas voted to finally change how slavery was explained to students in Texas. That was a recent thing that just happened in November.
Yeah, so, you know, I'm sitting here thinking about this, the nexus between active scholars, professional scholars in colleges and universities who are producing historical works, and how that work reverberates out and down and across and makes its way into history textbooks. And so the history that Donald lays out, right, is tracked by the trajectory of professional historians, white historians primarily, who are also deeply invested in white supremacy. And so if you're deeply invested in white supremacy, you're deeply invested in the lost cause narrative. You're invested in moving slavery away from away from being the central reason of the Civil War, right? So the historical profession, right, is still grappling with the realities of white supremacy. Fortunately, we're now in a space and in a context, right, where we've got several generations of scholars, of historians now who are pushing back mightily against these white supremacist notions. And so now we can access all manner of content that deepens and sharpens and broadens our historical analysis of instances like the Civil War, instances like the cultural flowering in the early 1920s, known as the Harlem Renaissance, right? And thinking about how the Renaissance, what are the implications of the Renaissance's impact, not just on Black folk, but on the nation as a whole, right? The Jazz Age. Well, who's creating jazz, right? That's African Americans, right? Newsflash, right? So now we're in a process where we've got to do the work of connecting and inserting African-American history in particular, from my view, but also the histories of other marginalized groups. So, again, we can get a fuller rendering and fuller understanding of history. And there's mighty, mighty pushback here, right? You know, the textbooks, you know, referencing enslaved people as laborers or as immigrants, right? You know, there's still our default mode in probably a majority of the states, I would say. I'll defer to Donald on that. But I would say in a majority of our states, there is still a deep reluctance to deal with the full implications of the presence of African Americans in the nation, right? And what those implications are for the nature of our democracy, what they are for our images, our ideas related to justice and equality and inclusion, what it means to be a citizen, right? You know, all of these things are impacted by the presence of non-white people. And so as long as we continue to not include non-white people in our histories, we are diminished. We're historically diminished, we're intellectually diminished, and we're democratically diminished, right? We don't have a clear understanding of what it means to be a citizen. If we don't have a clear understanding of how that term has shifted over the years, and if we can't have that conversation again, if the only stars of our show are a very specific group of people.
Before we take some calls, the repercussions of, again, if not understanding, the cause of slavery, there was a report by the Southern Poverty Law Center. The statistic was it found only 8% of high school students in American schools could identify slavery as the root cause of the Civil War. You're a historian, a teacher. What's your reaction to that?
That sounds about right. I routinely teach. I'm a professor of African American history, and I teach in Tennessee, right? So I'm routinely having to deprogram students in Tennessee, right? You know, we just recently removed our Confederate monuments, right? So we just recently removed our monument to Nathan Bedford Forrest. You know, as I like to call him, my favorite slave trading racial terrorist, right? So we are still in the throes of this dilemma, right? Of this white supremacist narrative, because again, it diminishes us, and so I routinely have to confront students and inform students about the reality of the fact that, you know, yes, I'm sorry, little Timmy, little Jenny, right? Yeah, it was slavery, right? It wasn't states' rights. States' rights to do what? Right. You know, states' autonomy to engage in what? To engage in the practice of buying and selling human beings. Right. So that's an ongoing struggle.
You can join our conversation on Where We Live, 860-275-7266. First, Rob's calling from Cost Cobb. Rob, go ahead.
Yeah. Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I am very much in support of broadening the discussion of our history and incorporating all aspects of it. My question to your esteemed guests is, when you get into the notion of sort of separating it or partitioning it into African American studies or Latino studies, it makes for an easy lightning rod, especially for those on the, let's call it the racial right, who will see it as, you know, easily attacked. So my question is, in the academic world, is there any discussion of, you know, redefining the nomenclature and calling it something like total history or complete history, or in order to avoid all the naysayers who don't want to support this discussion of the truthful history or the real history?
Thank you, Rob, for your call. I want to get Donald Yakovone back into the conversation. Donald, did you want to respond to Rob's point?
Well, yeah, I understand his point, and he's right in that the far right will use this, they'll use anything to support white supremacist principles. But the term, it's American history. That's what we're talking about here. It's all our histories. I mean, I'm not going to be real. I'm half Italian and half Polish. Am I going to only have the right to write about Italians and Polish people? This is ridiculous. This is American history. This is who we are. This is what we have become. And in order to change, we have to know, we have to be trained in what has happened before. This is why history is so vital to the future of the country.
Allie's calling from New Haven. Allie, your question.
Yeah, my comment, thank you for taking my call, and I'm fascinated to continue listening to your guests. It's such an important conversation. It's one that we all need to keep having, so thank you. However, I find myself often surprised, I think in even the entire 20 minutes I've been listening, that Native people and Native Americans have not come up in this conversation. I was actually schooled in a very privileged setting back in Cleveland, Ohio, and it taught us endlessly about Native culture. We went to the Natural History Museum once a month, and I just always feel like they are often left out of the conversation. So that was my comment.
Thank you, Allie, for your call. Charles, did you want to respond to Allie's point?
I think it's a great point. You know, if we really want to be serious about contending with the true scope and nature of American history, we have to include indigenous peoples, right? We have to include First Nations. I was just, a friend of mine just told me about this app that enables you to type in your zip code, and then it will give you the name of the indigenous group that that was the first occupants of your zip code, right? And so I'm thinking about, you know, I think about that all the time, right? We can't have, if we want to have a true conversation about the history of Memphis, the city of Memphis is 200 years old this year, and so we're gearing up to celebrate the 200-year anniversary. And we can't have that conversation without talking about the folks who were here first, right? And, you know, and their relationship with the immigrants, right? European and African. And so that's a vital and crucial component of our history, most definitely.
You can join our conversation again. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. I wanted to also bring up, you know, lately, in the last few years, there is more attention in this country with structural inequality. But again, when we talk about understanding and knowing our history, without knowing that, is it hard for some Americans to really understand the roots of inequality today, Charles?
Yes, I think that's exactly right. And history, bad history, contributes to that. A quick example, right? World War II, we fought against the Japanese, we fought against the Germans, and we fought against a racist ideology, right? But we did that with a segregated army, right? We did that as a nation that had avowed segregation, racial subordination, racial apartheid, right? We were the most advanced racially segregated nation in the country, right? In the world, right? So, but the way we teach the civil rights movement, as if it's completely disconnected from earlier moments, right? So, you know, so when I tell my students that we went to war with a segregated army, when I tell my students that that black men were not allowed initially in the Marines, right? That that black men and women served in segregated units and fought vociferously against segregation during this war, during the Second World War. They have no concept of that, right? They have no understanding of that whatsoever, right? And so, again, when we segment the history, when we purge these realities from our narratives, we are diminished, right? You know, what does it mean that African American veterans came home and were brutally harassed after World War I and World War II, right? For asserting their citizenship, for asserting their right to be fully included in the mainstream of American life. And so, again, if we don't have an understanding of that, if we don't have the opportunity to grapple with these complexities and these contradictions, then we're baffled when Black Lives Matter pops up, right? We're baffled when, you know, a civil rights movement jumps off in the 1960s and, you know, and folks are like, well, what's this about? I don't understand why people are so angry, right? We don't understand current protests related to a whole host of issues if we don't have an understanding of this not being something new, but this being a manifestation of a longstanding tension, of a longstanding contradiction within our heritage.
Before we head to break, I did want to also raise the question of who's teaching history these days. There was a study by Northeastern University that found in the last decade post-recession, just the number of history undergrads have seen the steepest decline. I wanted to ask Donald just briefly, that concern that the people that are teaching history may not be exactly the right people to be teaching that history.
Well, it's a crisis that's developing. It seems to have the real dip seemed to have started with the recession, the Great Recession in 2008-2009. But you know, the problem here, I think, is you have professional historians who are writing now good, inclusive history, including Native peoples, people of color. That's not the problem. And even when textbooks are written that include this material, you have educators who essentially are not well-educated. You have a system that believes that anyone can teach high school history, which is why gym teachers are so often the ones who are given that assignment. I have to tell you that I was trained to be a teacher in Connecticut, and when I went on my teacher training my first experience with teaching, I was in a teacher lounge, which was Spartan, chairs around the edges, except in the middle of the room, there was one wooden armchair with an elderly white man seated there spouting off about the white man's burden. When you have teachers like this, when you have schools like this who show movies instead of engaging students with the reality of history, you've got a system which is corrupt and corrupting and sustains white supremacist principles.
And speaking of the system, there was a UNC study done in 2012 that found 88% of elementary school teachers considered teaching history a low priority. Why is that? Teachers didn't focus on history because students aren't tested on it at the state level. The thinking is, why teach something you can't test? So we're going to have to leave it there with Donald Iacovone, associate at the Hutchins Center for African and African-American Research, currently writing a book called Teaching White Supremacy, The Textbook Battle Over Race in American History. Donald, thanks for joining us.
Sure. Glad to help.
Charles McKinney will be sticking around with us as we continue our conversation after the break. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Again, the importance of history education, that's what we're focusing on today. We're going to hear about another historical time in our nation's history that has been overlooked right after the break. This is Where We Live from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. The lynchings of black people in America are among the ugliest chapters in our nation's history. But lynchings weren't just confined to the Deep South. My next guest has researched violence against Latinos in Texas. Monica Munoz-Martinez is assistant professor of American and Ethnic Studies at Brown University, also co-founder of the group Refusing to Forget. This is an educational nonprofit working to raise awareness about state-sanctioned violence against Latinos in Texas. Monica, welcome to our show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Unfortunately, we don't have too much time for this history lesson, but it is an important one to focus on for just a little bit. The historical context of what we're talking about when we look at the history of violence against Mexican Americans in Texas, tell us what was happening.
Yeah, so the history of anti-Mexican violence has largely been forgotten in public memory, but it's crucial to understanding long-seated anti-immigrant sentiment and even the way that people think about the border today. But as it turns out, hundreds of ethnic Mexicans were lynched in Texas alone since 1848 to the early 1920s. But when we think more specifically about anti-Mexican violence, one of the characteristics of this forms of violence was that people suffered from gross tragedies, not just at the hands of mobs, but also state-sanctioned violence. And so there were intersecting regimes of policing. So there were vigilantes, but also law enforcement officers, Texas Rangers, which are the state police officers, and U.S. soldiers in the early 20th century committed murders. And so historians estimate that just in the decade between 1910 and 1920, hundreds, if not thousands, of ethnic Mexicans were murdered during this period. And so it's an important period to remember and to engage with critically. So the work that I'm doing with Refusing to Forget is to participate in conversations about what public history in Texas should look like. And so we're collaborating with cultural institutions like the Bob Bullock Texas State History Museum, and we've also helped to unveil 4 Texas State historical markers to help shed light on this period. That there's a great deal of research and publications by professional historians that have documented this era, but there's a big gap between the public school curriculums and what museums and monuments recognize about violence in this era.
So tell us more about that gap. So what is the narrative? What are the lessons that Texas students are learning about Texas and their quest for independence?
Well, the myths of Texas history that have been so deeply enshrined in public school lesson plans and museums and monuments, and of course in Hollywood depictions of this era, they overlook, or at worst, they celebrate histories of racial violence as progress. And so right now, Texans are celebrating Texas History Month, which really harkens back to this myth of the place of Texas, the history of Texas beginning with the Texas Revolution, which of course ignores the long history of Native nations that inhabited the land, but also intersecting and layered histories of colonization, so Spanish colonization and conquest, and then Mexican occupation of the era. And so what we also forget with the history of Texas Revolution is the driving force of slavery and the belief in white superiority that justified conquest and colonization of that region. And so when we have celebrations of the Texas Revolution that overlook that violent aspect and that history of the quest for slavery, but also the quest to displace landed Mexican elite members of society, we're left with is a history that celebrates that history quite uncritically.
Because we're not in Texas, I believe you were raised in Texas, Monica.
Yes, I grew up in South Texas.
Can you give us an idea when we think about who some of these heroes are in Texas, and again the mythology around them when you look at the facts of what they did?
Yeah, so, well, I mean, there's, of course, people like Stephen F. Austin and Sam Houston, but also some of the biggest icons in Texas history are the Texas Rangers. And these are the state police force that in the 19th century were charged with creating this new racial hierarchy, which relied on the violent policing of Mexicans that were living in Texas, but also of Native inhabitants. And so they were the architects of Native genocide, but participating in acts of racial violence. And so we don't have access to that history more broadly in popular representations. Instead, these Texas Rangers are glorified as the ideals of Anglo-masculinity and patriotism. And so when we think about the ways in which the current debates about the need to police the border and the criminalization of racial and ethnic minorities, that has a long history, or those ideals are shaped by the way that history has been misrepresented. And so I think that's part of also why, so, you know, when we think about to make connections to debates about rethinking the Confederacy or rethinking Civil War heroes, Texans have a long way to go to actually grapple with these long histories of slavery and Native genocide and anti-Mexican violence that were crucial to nation building and state building in Texas and in the U.S. in general.
I want to take a listener call. Andy is calling from Bolton. Andy, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm an adoptive father of two Puerto Rican children, so I connect very well with the idea of having these bills that that address teaching, you know, things that I missed when I was in Connecticut public schools in the 70s and 80s and early 90s. And there's so many pieces of their history that are becoming even more important as Puerto Ricans in Connecticut, because, we have the highest percentage of our people in Connecticut of any other state that are Puerto Rican. I have to research to tell them, you know, parts of their history about Amerindian genocide and about slavery and about, you know, how their people came together to become this blended population within Puerto Rico. I think it's really key that they start to be able to learn it in the schools, you know. So I wanted to ask, you know, the folks that you're talking to, you know, like, how can we incorporate those pieces that incorporate the, like, Puerto Ricans, have this blended culture and history of many different races and ethnicities, you know? How can we incorporate them kind of fluidly in the teaching that we give them?
Thank you, Andy, for your call. Monica, did you want to respond?
Yeah, well, it's absolutely important for, you know, when we think about teaching histories about race or ethnicity, that we find opportunities to find how these histories are interconnected. But what the caller is also speaking to is a broader need for not just children, but across the country, people just don't know Latinx history. You know, it's the common joke that the Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor makes, you know, when people ask her, like, when she immigrated to the United States, because so few people understand the history, not just of slavery and colonization, but also empire, U.S. empire, so that we have a critical understanding of U.S. intervention into the Caribbean nations, but also into places in Central America and into Mexico. And so when I think about ethnic studies courses, you know, it brings about a more critical understanding about histories of racial formation and histories of discrimination, but also a better understanding of U.S. foreign policy and international patterns of empire and colonization. And so that's one way of finding opportunities to couple these histories and to think through them in a way that gets so that we can think about race dynamically.
Charles McKinney is with us from Memphis, Tennessee. Charles, we've only got 2 minutes. I'm putting you on the spot. But again, when we talk about these memorials, these monuments to honor people who have oppressed and have done worse to people of color in our nation's history, some will say, well, you're erasing history by removing the statues. How do you respond to those critiques?
I respond to those critiques by quoting a friend of mine that said, well, according to that logic, then we should not have removed any of our statues to King George III after we won the Revolutionary War. But we did remove those statues because we won the war. But we also removed those statues because narratives change. And that's the thing, I think, that's the bottom line here. Narratives narratives change, interpretations change. And so just as textbooks will change, just as conversations will change, just as the things being taught in classes will change, the way we memorialize and think about the past should also change. And so I think it's perfectly appropriate for us to remove those monuments.
Charles McKinney is Director of Africana Studies and Associate Professor of History at Rhodes College in Memphis, Tennessee. Charles, we appreciate your perspective. Thank you.
Thank you.
Also with us, Monica Munoz-Martinez, Assistant Professor of American and Ethnic Studies at Brown University. We'll tweet out a link or put it on our website at wmpr.org/where we live, and a very interesting article about your work. Monica, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Today's show produced by Carmen Baskoff. Thanks to our technical producer, Kyone Wolf, and Lydia Brown was on the phones today. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Thanks for listening.